Now I've managed to insult the entirety of Europe.
You know, yeah, I'm probably going to have to edit that bit. That's probably a bit much.
I'm so sorry.
It's all right. Yeah, I don't take it personally.
Gabriel's got Tourette's today.
In tech we trust. Charge, we're not sure about.
Bonjour. Guten Tag. What? Good day. Hello. This is episode 92 of the In Tech We Trust podcast, coming to you live from three places, actually. Where are you, Mark?
Buenos dias, senor. I'm in California.
And Gabriel, where are you?
Hola. I am in San Francisco.
Do you know what? I don't even know where I should say I am anymore. I'm at home, right? It's in England. Is that part of the UK anymore? Is it part of Europe? Well, I guess technically it is right now.
Is it part of Less Britain?
Less Britain. Yeah. You know what? In my view, it'll always be part of Europe because that's the way the maps are drawn.
But the thing is, there's always been this like very small slither of ocean in between us. So I don't know. We're not big enough. The problem is, right, we're not big enough to be something on our own. That's the deal, right? We're kind of close to Europe, but we're not on the mainland. Anyway, never mind. I want to give, right, a genuine, heartfelt, extra special welcome to any listeners that are tuning in from Europe. Because you know what? There's been so much schmuck in the press about people in the UK being anti-European, being racist, all that jazz. I'm not having any of it. Me, I'm none of that. Anyway, so let me ask you the question, gents. I think I know the answer to it, right? But has this made the news and has it made it big time over in the States?
Go ahead, Gabriel.
It might have bumped Trump off the top. Well, actually, probably just the media conglomerates just feeding it like anything else. I mean, the thing is, most people couldn't find England on a map.
It's north of Spain.
Yeah, I just think it's strange. And it's like, you know, it's like all of a sudden all the Americans are, you know, all in concerned about Brexit. And now they're trying to draw corollaries between it and the United States. And they're throwing out words like racism and xenophobia. And, you know, in my viewpoint, it's just like, hey, it's a independent country that wanted to kind of control its own destiny. And we're probably tired of kind of having to suck up the costs for Portugal and Italy and Greece and Spain and half a dozen other half-ass countries that don't really do shit.
So much for that warm welcome to a European listener.
Sponge off the public tit of the countries that have their shit together.
Oh my gosh.
You know what? I love Portugal, Italy, Greece, and Spain to visit. But you know what? From a standpoint of a viable economic platform, country, whatever it is, their heyday is about 2,000 years ago, and they just need to come to grips that they're just going to be hangers-on and has-beens, and they just need to deal with it.
Standard disclaimer. The thoughts of Gabriel Chapman do not necessarily represent those of...
Make Britain great again. You know what? I should be your prime minister because you know what?
You sound like one of those guys that's like trying to speak to someone from Italy because you don't speak Italian. You shout at them.
I've been to all those countries. I mean, I've been all over Europe. I love visiting Europe and everything, but I can't get all like bent out of shape because the UK, which kind of has its stuff together for the most part when it comes to their finances and, you know, the direction, want to, you know, pull themselves out of something that I see as a fairly dysfunctional solution that probably should have been enacted back in 1945 instead of when it was. You know, because reality, the whole concept of the EU is really to kind of placate all the post-World War II BS between Germany and France. And, you know, we were at a point...
No. It was to create a market.
Yeah, the idea was the market was always there. And then if you look at what happened to all the small countries, if you look at what happened to all the small countries that were part of it, they got dragged into it. What happened to their currency and how it their inflation got all jacked up and out of whack, and things that they paid a certain amount of money for at a certain point in time were completely whatever. I'm just saying, it's like, so, you know what? I think the concept is great in theory. There's nothing to stop you from having a free trade agreement with all these countries. We have lots of free trade agreements with countries, and if you want a common currency, You know, I mean, I guess you can peg it to the euro, but the reality was they always had the British pound, so it didn't matter.
So, no, let me give you the temperature of what it's like over here in the UK, right? Okay, it's cold and it's windy and it's raining like it always is, right? But around this whole Brexit thing, and we will get to the technology impacts hopefully very shortly, right? Thing is, right, it's the only thing anybody is talking about, and I don't just mean the media and the press and what have you. I do the school run. It's all the parents are talking to me about. I had workmen at the house today and yesterday. It's the only thing we're talking about. The thing is, right, I dread to say this, Gabriel, you were almost on the button with what you said there, minus some of the harshness, right? The thing is, right, the vast majority of people in the UK that voted, even on the day that they were voting, really were kind of undecided. Yeah, we kind of like a lot of what Europe is about, but we kind of don't like the whole package, right? And I would say a good 95%+ of people are right in the middle there. Look, at every extreme, you know, there's extreme people wanting to be out, extreme people wanting to be in. Very small numbers, in my opinion, right? Most people are around the middle, and they like what you talked about there. They like the single market and the free trade and all that kind of stuff, and they like European people. I mean, hello, Hans, hello, Arjan, hello, Enrico, all those people out there. We freaking love you, right? What we don't want is we don't want the currency. We don't want this like big monolithic government that we can't really unelect if we don't like them. And, you know, we have less say in some of the decisions that are made. I think that's what it boils down to. Nobody that I have spoken to, and I have spoken to loads of people, nobody hates Europeans, okay? Nobody wants anything nasty to happen to them. Yeah, I mean,
no, I totally agree with you. And that's why I think it's stupid for people to kind of ramp this into some kind of xenophobia. You want to see a xenophobic country? Go to Japan, right?
There's a country. We'd like to give a wave to our Japanese listeners.
All two of them.
Yeah. But no, I mean, you want to see a society that is fairly xenophobic. I mean, it's not like I'm saying anything that people don't know. If you're a white dude and you're living in Japan, and like I worked at a company where I worked with people that were completely fluent in Japanese, and when they would meet a counterpart for the first time, the person was kind of like, you could see them in their face go, holy shit, wait, you were a white dude? And then all of a sudden the entire relationship changed because they were gaijin or whatever the hell you want to call it. There are certain societies, there's certain, you know, certain cultures on this planet where it's like, you know what, if you're not part of the tribe, you're just not going to be ever part of it. You know, you're never going to fit in no matter how hard you try or whatever. And, you know, I mean, I think trying to mash up, you know, 35 different disparate nations with vast histories of personal identity.
Killing each other?
Say again?
Vast histories of killing each other?
Well, yeah, not only that, yeah, not only, you know, but you know, if you go do a DNA test, I mean, I guarantee you, everybody over there shares a lot more commonality than disparity for the most part, right? It's just strange that, you know, it's like the UK can't pull out of this for what I look at from economic and kind of personal, you know, personal direction reasons without getting a bunch of crap. And, you know, it's probably going to be the downfall of the EU in totality. And maybe, you know, they could try it again at some other point when we adopt the whole Star Trek way of living. But we're just not there yet as a society. You know, these are all independent countries still. It seems something like, you know, I don't get why everybody's trying to take their personal pet issue and push it on this as if it's relevant, when the reality is, I think it's a lot of people in the UK just like, you know, wanted to kind of keep some of their national identity intact. And there's nothing wrong with that.
So go on, Mark, we've not heard from you. Have you got any thoughts on it yourself?
No, I think it's a whole xenophobic, lying bunch of bag of crap. No, what looks like it may be obvious here, and as it happens with all things like this, that the campaigns mounted on both sides to remain and leave were effective or ineffective, and that the leave campaign had effective points that they made that they are not prepared to stand behind, right? The £350 million pounds a week that go to the EU that they would spend on NHS, a lie. They're not going to do that. You know, that's been brought up. But the Remain campaign, it looked like they were just, you know, fear-mongering. It's like, well, if we leave, we're going to have this big disaster. And they brought out old politicians that people really didn't care about anymore. And that they didn't talk about what the advantages of actually being in Europe were. That they just talked about the fear of what would happen. And so the analysis that I read that I thought was really interesting is you had two campaigns you know, that we're both negative. Let's just get rid of this. Not like, let's, you know, a little bit of let's be our own boss, but like, let's just get rid of this. We're pouring money down the rat hole. The other one saying, if we leave, we're going to be a lot worse off. Right. And what are people supposed to do with those kinds of messages? Right. It's how we campaign over here too, all negative. It's just,
it sucks. It totally sucks. You know what? I said to my wife, leading up to the vote, I said, I will not make a massive decision like this, right, based on fear. There is absolutely no way I will be frightened into making one decision or another, right? I'm going to make it based on, well, at the end of the day, I made it based on what I thought was the more democratic system, okay? But I was never going to let fear come into it. And let
but,
me just...
But do you think, was that analysis that I just explained to you, was that accurate?
Oh, spot on, Mark. Absolutely. There was no... The thing is, right... some of them had, well, both campaigns, right, seemed to have maybe a moderate idea of what might happen in the short term. Then the rest of it, like the long-term stuff, massive big old punt. Nobody had a clue. So all they did was they started throwing crap at each other. And, I mean, that's modern politics for you, isn't
yeah,
it? Like when we run
that's politics, yeah.
It's probably, it might not be as bad in the UK as it is in the States yet. But whenever we're running for general elections and things, there's more like... there's more mud flinging at the opposition than there is about saying what you're going to do.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
So
whatever you say you're going to do is just, you know, it doesn't have to be truth. It's just storytelling.
You can say anything you want and get away with it. It's ridiculous. Yeah. Anyway,
pretty much.
So before we get on to tech, I wanted to pick up on what you said there, Mark, about fear. My only concern here, right, I hate people trying to scaremonger and frighten people into making decisions. Doesn't matter whether it's politics or anything, right? I despise it. Now, my only concern is that the European Union won't take this vote for what I think it is, which is a bit of just a reality check to say, look, guys, you know what? We love a ton of what Europe is, like what Gabriel said at the beginning, the single market, the free trade, all that kind of stuff. We just don't like the rest of it in its current incarnation. I'd love them to take that and say, oh, you know what? Maybe we need to reform and do things differently. People are not happy. What I'm worried about is that they're going to turn around and try and punish... well, I'm not worried, actually. They can do it. I'm not bothered. I'll take it on the chin. But I wonder if they're going to try and punish the UK in order to put the fear of God up other countries to say, oh, well, we don't leave in case that happens to us. And I can see it happening because, again, in my opinion, that is what politics is like these days.
What are they going to do? Stop buying tea? Stop banking with the global banking facility on the planet. I mean, you know, yeah. There's going to be a lot of talking. There's going to be a lot of people talking smack and, oh, you know, it's just like every election that happens over here. I'm moving to Canada. I'm moving to Cuba or whatever. And at the end of the day, everybody's like, oh, crap. You know what? I sure do like that product or that service or that company. And I'm still going to continue to use it. And people will huff and they'll puff and they'll talk crap and they'll bash their chest and they'll post crap on Facebook. And at the end of the day, nothing will change at all.
At the end of the day,
The funny thing is, I just don't see the impact being as significant as people really do. Outside of right now, what's being done is people are trying to punish British currency, right? Or they're trying, you know, markets are being markets and they're fluctuating based on news that they did not anticipate, right? But there'll be a point where things stabilize just like they always do. And then at the end of the day, people will be like, all right, well, you know, the Brits are no longer here and, you know, it's business as usual.
Yeah. And they'll attempt to punish, Vodafone subscribers in Europe or in the UK when they travel in Europe, but that'll level out over time. I just think you should do what I suggested in the blog post I wrote, which is join the United States as the 51st state, you know, buy lots of guns, you know, put the NFL together with the British Premier League, make sure Putin doesn't get his hands on the Queen, all kinds of great jobs, building a pipeline from Scotland to Maine. I mean, you know, you should come on, join the U.S.
Never mind building the pipeline. Did you not hear my response to that? Why don't we just, like, we'll stick some oars on the side of the UK and we'll just row the country over there.
Come on over.
We'll bolt it on to somewhere off of the coast of Florida where the weather's nicer.
Look,
I'd be game for that.
You'd be part of the biggest army. You know, what are those guys in Europe going to say? It's like, we want to negotiate. We've already negotiated. And like I said, you know, we'll have to retrofit cars so you have steering wheels on both sides and stuff like that. No big thing. You know, no big deal.
Hey, but it creates jobs in the meantime, right?
Lots of jobs.
Lots of jobs.
Yeah. Plus, we would finally figure out where the UK is, right? If you guys joined us, we would know where you are. And then, you know, no long customs lines getting off airplanes between Kennedy and Heathrow in LA and San Francisco and all. Just flying over. God, you guys could fly to Hawaii and not have to go through customs, right?
Hey, I've got a question for you, right? Speaking of where the UK is on the map, you know, when you guys have like a map on the wall, what's in the middle of the map? Do you guys have the states in the middle, or do you have like Europe, the UK and Africa down the middle?
No, those parts don't exist on maps.
I think we've got like 50 miles off the coast of Portugal. I think we've got the Azores right in the middle.
You should have trolls on your map.
I have no trolls.
I love those old time maps. Yeah, and we're done with Brexit. I've insulted enough of the Earth right now. So,
yeah, let's switch this on to the technical implications of this, and we will cover some tech news as well. But to be honest, tech news that I've got right now is Brexit, and business news. Yeah, that's Brexit as well. But just before we pivot onto like the more focused technical impacts, right? I just want to put out a disclaimer. Everything that Gabriel said there does not necessarily represent what I think, right?
No. Me too.
What
me
we
too.
Want is reform
me too.
For Europe. We do love them.
And Japan. I
you know what? I just have to represent the ugly American class. So,
yeah.
You know, ignorant flyover country people, you know.
How are you in Israel, by the way?
I was a Middle Eastern studies major for a while. I'm a friend of Israel. They love me.
They're just as xenophobic as Japan.
No. They're usually less – well, they're probably less xenophobic Japan. Then again, not everyone is trying to kill everyone in Japan that lives around them. So there's a little bit of a disparity there.
Got a good tech startup scene though.
Oh, yeah, they do. A lot of great tech.
Right, cool. So let's pivot on to some of the more technical impacts of this, right? Well, maybe we'll whiz through them. I don't know. So, hey, let's mention Gartner. Not that I listen to anything that they say, right? But they're predicting that IT spending in the UK is going to go through the floor.
Yeah, they gave a negative. They gave a negative growth. I mean, how? I mean, they're going to spend less money.
Negative growth, yeah. And yeah. But they gave the world IT spend, so the global IT spend, that was still in the positive, but it was sharply reduced. I think, right?
It was turned down somewhat. But the thing about negative is like, really? So they were going to spend this, and now they're going to spend a lot less, I guess. I wasn't quite sure.
Oh, so you don't mean negative as in we're going to unspend on IT. Instead of spending 500 million, we'll take 500 million back from the industry. No?
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks for that, Gartner. Interesting, right? So European startups, London is currently like the center of Europe when it comes to tech startups, at least, right? Of course, it pales in comparison to the States. Potential impact there, though?
Yeah, I think the big impact there, right, is talent pool. And this is one of the big things that people are talking about. If you've got, you know, as part of the UK, people can travel anywhere and people can come from everywhere. So you've got, you know, aspiring coders that that want to write code and be a part of a company, be part of a startup. You know, if they're Europeans, they can just move to London, right? If they can afford to live in London. But the fact is you can pool those people together there. And there's a certain amount of that happening, right? And after the pullout occurs, it's not quite so easy, right? You know, they may be able to go and live there on a visa or something, but there's restrictions with that. And there could be, you know, numbers of restrictions. It's not just like anybody can come here and code. It's like, no, we actually have to work to make this happen. And
I mean, the thing is, right, we don't know who's going to be the Prime Minister of the UK going forward, okay? We don't even know the shape of the UK, to be honest. Scotland might leave and go independent and join Europe. Who knows, right? So there's a lot of unknowns there, right? But surely whoever is in the driving seat in the UK is not going to shoot the country in the foot. They're not going to make stuff like that hard, right?
Yeah, but, you know, then again, you get into the negotiations with the EU, right? And if you're not paying into the EU the same amount of money, then why should you have the same access to resources? This is part of the idea of the whole EU, right? We all have shared resources. We have shared government. People can move. Well, now if you're not supporting the EU, then why should the EU support you with talent?
And that's a fair shout, right?
Yeah, but you know what the thing is? It's not like the EU is supporting you with talent. It's people in the EU are moving to where talent is needed.
Yeah, the same thing happens in the United States. People don't come here because of our great immigration policy. They come here because it's where the jobs are.
Yeah, but there are issues, and you know, you've had technology leaders here saying, oh, we've got to open up the door so we can get more talent, right? The immigration aspect of bringing talented people here is an issue.
I mean, but it always has been. But if you look at who leads the charge in that, it's the tech companies themselves. It's like, hey, we want liberal immigration policies because we want to pay 5-to-1 wages. You know, I want to bring 5 people over here. And it's not like to bring somebody over here is cheap. Application for an H-1B visa is not it's like $20K. It's not – I mean, it's not like it's like free. Oh, by the way, here's your visa and come on over and work. The companies have to pay, and they have to pay services, and there's a bunch of – there's an entire economy built around visa importation for workers. The reality is, though, we don't have enough people talented-wise to do the work that needs to be done based on the tech scene that's lived here. And the same goes for other nations across the planet that have vibrant tech sectors.
Right. So you've got Cameron, who's now going to be out, and one of Cameron's agenda items was trying to grow the technology sector in the UK and London in particular. Right. Though maybe just as important is not the change of the pullout from the UK or from the EU rather, but the fact that somebody else that comes in to be prime minister may not see the same, probably won't have the same technology financial agenda that Cameron did.
I think though, Mark, even if they did, pulling out of the EU would certainly still pose challenges for them, because the two kind of large cities in Europe that the kind of center for tech startups are London and Berlin. Now, they must be wooting for joy in Berlin over this. I'm sure they're not okay. I'm sure they're a lot more respectful than that. But it certainly puts Berlin in a much stronger position versus London, from a financing perspective, from an access to the single economy, all that kind of stuff. Personally, I can see the dynamics there shifting a little bit, London struggling a little bit there. But I think, look, I'm British, right? So I think Britain and London and all that kind of stuff, I think they're pretty resilient. In fact, you know what? That's been one of the undertones of everybody I've spoken to. And it's in stark contrast to what the media are portraying. Everyone I've spoken to is actually quite optimistic about it all, looking forward to kind of reinventing and a clean slate. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's fine. You know, if you've got the cash to do it, if you've got resources to do it. So, you know, so think about Germany and Berlin, for instance, right? If maybe they want to fire up a technology sector too, and they just decide, okay, we're going to support the hell out of this. We're going to put a lot of money into it, and we're going to make it available to, you know, talent across, you know, the EU, and anybody can come here and start coding, and we'll start having hackathons all over the place. You know, they're probably doing that anyway. But if the money to support startups moves in Europe from London and in some percentage to some other center like Berlin, like Barcelona, who knows where else, right? And countries there start focusing on trying to make that happen, that will be to the detriment of the scene in London.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
I'm not saying that's going to happen, but it could, right?
Yeah. Hey, a bit of a tangent, right? So on the topic of data protection, right, there's been this thing, I guess, rumbling for quite a while now between the US and the EU, with the EU wanting to take quite a strict stance on what can and can't be done with European citizens' data if it's ever exported to the US. You know, what can you manipulate and munge that data for? And historically, right, when the UK was in Europe, and of course we're still in Europe for at least another couple of years, right, while we negotiate, or at least that's the way it looks at the moment, while we negotiate the leave. The UK has always been, I think, kind of a moderating voice in there, that, you know, France and Germany are very different to the US, if I can say that, in that the US are a lot more liberal when it comes to data protection. They're happy for people's data to be, you know, searched and analyzed and all that kind of stuff, whereas Germany and France are very much like, no, hands off, you're not taking the data out, you can't do this with it, when you get a hold of it, you can't do that. And the UK have really been a moderating voice there. Well, we don't have a seat at that table anymore, so I think it might be interesting to see how that whole, what do they call it? It's not safe harbor.
There's data sovereignty, there's safe harbor, there's, sovereignty is between nations, you can't transfer the data, safe harbor is just you can't get it and access it. What else is there, Gabriel?
It's primarily data governance issues, you know, and from a legal standpoint, I think it's probably a little more complex.
Gabriel and I just recorded something last week. I haven't published it yet, doing a ridecast. But, you know, we were talking about this very issue. In fact, here in the United States, it shreds, right? If you don't have any privacy whatsoever.
I mean, the government wants access to your data, they just take it. I mean, and the thing is, in their court, I mean, the courts are supposed to protect you and supposed to leverage it. But the reality is that it's never really worked all that great anyway.
Courts tend to rule with the FBI.
Yeah. They tend to, they tend to support, you just saw it recently with Apple and unlocking an iPhone with that jerk asshole who shot those people, right? And being able to open that up and get bypass Apple encryption. And you did see a concentrated effort by the technology community to basically give the government the finger. Yeah, and rightfully so, because, you know, I just think that those are slippery slope issues that that we should be fighting against. The reality is, though, is the government probably break into anything that they wanted to and do so at will. And they pick and choose their battles to go public with in order to see if they can gain enough public backing. Right. So if they come, they wouldn't come after it for some guy who is, embezzling money from a company to try to crack into his phone. But if it's an act of terrorism, they'll leverage that and the hoopla around that to have public opinion get behind them and possibly influence the courts. And that's the way I tend to view it. I think that the government has full access to everything that we do and that you have exactly zero privacy regardless of what country or where you're operating. And you haven't since pretty much, the last decade plus.
But is there a difference between the government accessing your data and things like that versus commercial enterprises analyzing your data and generating business and generating revenue and generating sales and generating jobs out of it?
Well, model, right? Because the Facebook resells and leverages your data on a daily basis. Same thing with Google, same thing with Microsoft, everybody else under the sun, right? It's part of their revenue model.
The U.S. data protection is pretty cool towards stuff like that, right?
In terms of allowing the company to do whatever they want, because when you sign into Facebook and you've accepted the terms and conditions that basically say we can do whatever the hell we want with your information, then, that's it. That's how the courts have ruled. I don't know how prevalent that is in Europe and other nations.
So actually, the difference between government and business is fairly large. And you look at something like NATO. North Atlantic Treaty Organization, it's a military consortium of all these countries. I think there's 28 countries right now that are in NATO, and it's bigger than the EU. It is, it's a lot of different countries, and they fight terrorism together. And if the police networks, the equivalent of the FBI security, internal security, wants to go in and get information about people and they want to share that with other countries in the name of fighting terrorism, they're going to. And then when you cross that border and you show them your passport and they enter that information in, it's possible that something that somebody gleaned off of your web browser could show up at a security checkpoint. And it could just be something like, friendly to gay communities, friendly to, something else, right? And the next thing somebody's like following you, asking you a lot of questions, that sort of thing. It's like, who wants that?
Nobody.
No.
So that's the difference between business and government. Governments can be a lot nastier than businesses can.
Oh, yeah.
Businesses don't put you in jail and don't let you have access to lawyers and that sort of thing. Governments can.
Yeah.
And we're talking about some of the governments of some of the smaller countries in NATO especially, right? They're crazy places.
It's funny. It's like, it's kind of like that idiot who was over in North Korea and decided, like, what did he do? He tore a sign down or something like that.
Yeah.
And then, like, you're going to go to a really bad place for being an idiot, right?
Yeah.
And there are countries out there that don't tolerate stupid stuff at any level. And, we can do all the dumbest stuff you want in the United States for the most part. And the same thing happens with your data.
Yeah, NATO doesn't have any concerns about human rights. NATO is about security, pure and simple, right? And you might give lip service to human rights, but it's about security.
But I don't think that anything that's going on with the EU and Brexit and what have you, I don't know that that necessarily has any impact on that, does it? Because NATO still exists. There's no changes there. Governments are going to get what they want at the end of the day.
It's completely different. So you've got countries like Albania, Romania, Austria's weird, Estonia. You've got countries where the view of human rights is quite a bit different than what we have in England and the U.S.
Yeah, you have the right to be searched no matter what.
Hey, actually, so you saying you have the right to be, that's just reminded me, actually, this whole right to be forgotten, are you guys aware of that in the EU with regards to, I think, Google searches and things like that? So if you do something really stupid and you don't want that showing up on search histories and stuff, the EU was, I don't know if it ever got through, but they were certainly pushing to be able to have like your kind of sketchy history from your past deleted from search engines and stuff.
God, maybe we should join the EU.
Yeah. No, but the thing is, right, I appreciate that, and this is only my personal opinion, right? I'm just not a big fan of that. I understand, right, if I had done something really stupid, I might think differently, but I'm just not a big fan of editing history, whitewashing it. And I know certainly within the EU, while the UK had a seat at that table, we were a lot more liberal on things like that than some of the other voices there, in particular Germany and France, who were very much in favour of this right to be forgotten. And also very much in favor of not allowing data to be exported and used and analyzed and stuff by US companies. I'm not saying that the UK were totally open to it, but we were certainly a counterbalance at those negotiation tables. Well, you know what? In 2 years' time, we're not going to be there anymore. So it might be interesting just to see how EU data protection pans out and the potential impact that has on business between the EU and the States as well going forward, because, you know, companies like Google, Microsoft, Facebook, they're all US based and they want hold of your data and they want to be able to analyze it and make money off of it.
That's probably the most interesting thing that's going to come out of this podcast, is that it's not the change in England, it's the change in the EU, with England not being there as a balance point for these kinds of things and what that means to U.S. technology companies. I think you have just really nailed it, Nigel. That's the thing we were searching for in this show.
Oh, I completely changed my whole viewpoint now.
You know what? Since the Leave campaign won, the number of people that have been like, yeah, you know, I voted out. Kind of wish I maybe hadn't now, so...
In fact, can we join and do this retroactively so we can vote back in?
Yeah. It's funny that, right? So there was something in one of the papers or something saying that, you know, isn't democracy a great thing until you don't get what you wanted, and then suddenly like dictatorships look a little better as long as your family's in charge. But the tagline on it was that England were playing Iceland a couple of days later, and it's like, well, I'll tell you what, you know, if the unthinkable happens, and it never will, but just say, you know, 1,000,000-to-1 shot Iceland were to beat England, you know, do you think we'd be saying, well, actually, can we replay the game and replay it and replay it until England win? And then once we win, we'll be happy. Well, never mind, they beat us. So,
well, what we do here is 4 games out of 7.
What a great idea. Surely they'd never beat us 4 games out of 7. Yeah, but actually, I've got to tell you, there's this petition has to go in front of Parliament now. So you can do an online petition over here in the UK, and as long as it gets 100,000 signatures against it, it has to be at least heard by Parliament. So there's this petition that got something like probably 500,000 signatures on it now that says we actually want another vote, and the terms of the vote this time are, in order to leave, we've got to have like a 75% say that we want to leave, and we need to have 95% turnout to the actual vote. It's like, really, guys, you know, we live in a somewhat democratic society, okay? Just because it doesn't go your way, you can't suddenly like, well, let's change the law and actually we won't go with what the people have said. It's crazy.
Yeah, I was just looking that up. It looks like there's 2.5 million people that have signed the petition now.
Oh, is that right?
Well, that news was like 3 days ago, so that's not right. Yeah.
Well, it's probably even more by now, because it only needed to get 100,000 signatures before it has to be heard by Parliament. Seriously, I mean, it'll be heard by Parliament, but they won't do anything about it. Can you imagine that? I mean, I based my vote on the fact that I thought the UK's parliamentary democracy was a more democratic system than what we've got in Europe. And then if they were suddenly to say, actually, we don't like the results of this vote, let's have another one and let's change the goalposts here. Yeah.
Let me read this to you because I think it's so fascinating. It says an online petition signed by more than 3.5 million people calling for a second referendum on whether Britain should leave the EU was started by a Leave campaigner who says it's been, quote, hijacked by unhappy Remain voters.
Oh,
yeah. You know what? No one has paid attention to California in our referendum system because that is a complete clusterfuck.
Oh, come on. It's the best in the world.
It's the worst. It's like the dumbest thing ever. It's completely hijacked by special interest. It results in the worst legislation to ever pass. It's a complete sham. And guess what? Direct democracy blows. That's why we're a representative republic.
Yeah.
Yeah. We should have our representatives make these decisions for us. But, you know, then we do have problems with that.
Not far either. But, you know, it's like just leave me alone.
The thing is, right, this whole Brexit thing, right when it first started, I was like so miffed. I'm like, you know what? So I can't stand politics at the end of the day. I like technology, and I've had to kind of come out of my technology bubble and actually do a bit of thinking about politics. And that's miffed me, right? Because every 5 years, I elect somebody to make these hard decisions for me. Like, I've elected a government that is supposed to be experts and specialists in this. And they're asking the people, 99% of who are thick as two short planks and haven't got a clue. And look what we end up with. It's no small surprise, is it?
We have a very – I would say we have a fairly dumb electorate, and I think most countries do. Yeah. Because most people are – you know, they're low information. They don't pay attention. They don't read between the lines. They don't do any research. They don't really pay attention. You know, it's like, oh, hey, look, Honey Boo Boo's on, or I could read through the voter pamphlet. Which one do you think I'm going to do?
Yeah.
You know, and that's the flaw with, you know, democracy as a whole. You know, if you give the plebs bread and circuses, they're going to choose, you know, the choice between bread and circuses and actually making any tough decisions, they're going to choose bread and circuses every time. And, you know, it's just the way the masses work, right? And that's why people who are competent rise to the top and eventually gain control. And then these cycles happen, you know. I'm just waiting for our Greek cycle to come to fruition and everything to collapse around it, and then for another Dark Ages, and then we can all start it all over again.
In China.
Hey, Nigel, I want to ask you a question.
Yeah, shoot.
As a cell phone user, what's going to happen? What do you think is going to happen in a couple of years?
Oh, you know what? Yeah, that's a really good question, actually, because for our European listeners, this has been quite a big thing over the last few years. So, of course, we're all like lots of small little countries, right? And so I take my cell phone in the past, right, and I go just across the water to France or to Germany or to the Netherlands or somewhere, right? And I pay through the frickin' teeth for roaming, especially for data. Oh my goodness, it was disgusting. Now, one of the many good things, I've got to be fair, right, that the EU brought was it put an end to that, or it is in at least, you know, a moderate way through putting an end to that. We have pretty good roaming charges and things now. They're not allowed to extort the public like they used to be. There is the potential, and look, everything's up in the air, right? I mean, I can't speak authoritatively on anything, but there is lots of talk that all of that good stuff will go out the window, and UK cell phone users, as we go abroad, will be shafted once again. So that is one of the...
I don't get charged squat when I go overseas.
Yeah, well, I'm kind of hoping that Google and its, what is it, Project Fi or Project Fi or something?
That's actually pretty, Lauren has that. That's supposed to be pretty bitching. I travel too much for it to be.
But Google's going to have to negotiate that with France and Germany.
True. Yeah. I don't know. The thing is, there's so many things like that that are kind of up in the air. It's a funny thing. I hope inside, right, that we keep a lot of this stuff from Europe. Because like I said at the beginning, you know, nobody here really hates Europe. We liked a lot of the good stuff. And I'd love the UK to keep it. But I wonder, you know, like you, I think you were suggesting earlier, Mark, is that fair and is that realistic? You know, if we're not contributing financially and all that kind of jazz anymore, just to say, oh, hey, that's a pretty good law. We'll just implement that in the UK. And, you know, can we all come to agreements on that? It's probably, I don't know, wishful thinking.
So another area that I think is really interesting around this, right, that people are trying to figure out is the cloud business. What's the impact of the cloud business today? Because there's uncertainty about what's going to go on. But if you talk about data sovereignty, you talk about safe harbor, you know, what about cloud infrastructure that may be built in the UK versus cloud infrastructure that may be built in an EU company or country? Is that going to give an advantage, you know, to somebody that might be competing with a UK site for one of the big vendors to build a cloud, whether it's, you know, Amazon, Google, Microsoft, you name it?
Yeah, you know what? I'd reckon it would put the UK at a disadvantage. I don't know how huge that would necessarily be, but I think it certainly would, because at the end of the day, for all of these companies, it is, instead of the whole of Europe being like one standard data protection set of guidelines and laws and things, one set of intellectual property, you know, we were getting to a point where all of that kind of stuff was starting to become common across the whole of the EU. Now suddenly the UK is different, and it's like, oh, actually, to do business and to set up in the UK and what have you is no longer as seamless as it was or as it would be were it still part of the EU. And you know what? The Irish economy, you know, Amazon and Microsoft and a lot of tech companies have got sizable presences in Ireland.
I think we need to explain to some of the audience that Ireland's not in the UK.
No, correct. Yeah. So Ireland will potentially benefit massively, I guess, from the bleed out of the UK if it does become that much more difficult, I guess, to do business within the UK. Please, enough about Brexit. At least one story that is pure kind of tech and business tech, right? And I love this. It's, you know, it's Microsoft continuing to go forward, right? I don't know how many people noticed, but Microsoft announced .NET Core 1.0. Check this out, right? They announced it at Red Hat's Dev Nation event. I mean, Microsoft and Red Hat, I grew up, they were like mortal enemies, right?
Whoa.
Yeah. That's like, and that is like totally cool news in my opinion. You know, Brexit's good, it's bad, it's nobody really knows. I don't see anything bad to this, right? A forward-thinking Microsoft, embracing open source and all that kind of jazz. So they talked about Red Hat Enterprise Linux is currently the only Linux flavor out there, the only Linux distribution out there with full support for Microsoft.NET. Now, this is the interesting thing, right? Apparently, one of the things that it's going to do is it's going to make .NET workloads really, really easy to port between Windows and Linux. And I guess vice versa. Now, shout me down if you think I'm wrong here, but I would imagine the direction would generally be from Windows to Linux, but could be totally wrong about that. Don't know if either of you have a thought on that.
No. This is amazing. It looks like Microsoft is trying to not stem the tide, but give people options if they want to start leaving, you know, Microsoft technology to use other platforms in the cloud, right? This is incredible.
It's more than stemming the tide, isn't it? They're actually opening up a floodgate to say, okay, Windows applications and Windows workloads, workloads that in the past had to run on Windows, here's a route or a route for you to get off the Windows platform and go and run your existing code and your new code going forward based on .NET on Linux. Now, I know that we appreciate that, like, Windows and the operating system model is not the cash cow that it once was, but I mean, I'm still quite surprised at that personally.
I'm just quickly scanning this article in the Register, and it says that the rationale that Microsoft gives is that the loss in Windows Server licenses, which is already flat, there's no growth in Windows Server, right? There's nothing going on there, will be made up by the increase in cloud services revenues, right? So they're trading Windows Server for cloud services. They're making
that
swap.
And that is a bona fide manifestation of a cloud-first strategy, right?
Absolutely.
Do you reckon that was internally? Sorry, go on, Mark.
Well, it's probably not that hard internally, considering that a lot of the Windows Server team has already moved to cloud anyway. Okay. Right. A lot of the people that were working on, you know, server software, including SQL Server, those people have been moved to cloud. And so they know that the future is cloud. And so, you know, I'd say there's more people working on cloud than on Windows Server, more people working on cloud than on Windows, you know, SQL that runs on Windows. Right. So everything's going there. So most people at Microsoft, I would think, would say, good, this shows that the company moved me over here. And in fact, they're standing behind us and behind that move. I'd feel bad if I was still working on Windows Server, that's for sure.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Hey, so speaking of the future, right, just in case this missed or this slipped under the radar with some of the DockerCon podcasts that we had last week, I saw the flipping future at DockerCon last week. So Mark Rozinovich, of considerable fame at Microsoft, was on the stage at DockerCon. He had an Azure stack running on some physical servers on stage with him, and he ran Microsoft SQL Server on Linux, containerized SQL Server running on Ubuntu Linux on top of Azure Stack in front of a live audience. Now, seriously, so there, in that mix, there was containers. There was SQL Server running on Linux, so a Linux container on top of an Ubuntu Linux host on Azure Stack. Now, we haven't got time for it in this week's podcast, right? But Azure Stack, I know it's in public beta at the moment, or tech preview, I think they call it. That is one flipping exciting technology, I think, there. But yeah, I just wanted to say, I saw the future last week, and Microsoft was square and central in that picture.
Very, very interesting.
So, you know what, there we go. A nice tech story to kind of bring us towards the end of the podcast. Let's wind the podcast out with, Mark, you've got something new going on, right? Which I think is pretty interesting, especially for potential listeners of the podcast, because podcast listeners are people that consume content that talks about technology and stuff. Tell us what you got going, Mark.
I started this thing called the Ridecast a few months ago. And the idea is, you know, the stuff that people make in cars, and people that have followed me for a while, they know that I used to like to do steering wheel cameras, which were monologues of me driving around and opining on stuff. But, you know, that's not really that interesting. And so when I became a freestyler, if you will, independently employed back in February, I just started looking, what's going on in cars? You know, James Corden's carpool karaoke, all kinds of other stuff. Crazy Arabians driving cars on two wheels and taking the wheels off on the, you know, the wheels that aren't touching the ground, stuff like that. Just interesting things that people are doing in cars. But at the same time, I started thinking, you know, so what if there was a way to do like car stuff to do technology news, you know, on a small, short scale. So I just started messing around with that. And that's where this idea of like VulcanCast came from. You know, the idea that I can be in my car, the car is the studio, I can call people up or Skype with them, I can have conversations while I'm driving around, kind of conversations that people have in cars all the time, right? And so I just started doing that basically last week at the start of DockerCon. You know, I had a few of these things before, but I just started like, okay, let's see if I can hit a rhythm and see if I can start getting, you know, one to two to three of these things every day. And it's been kind of fun, right? You know, I call people up and, you know, like Greg Nierman in Cleveland. So I'll call Greg Nierman and, you know, I just put a picture of him in the passenger seat. Well, he sent me a picture that was him in the driver's seat. So I had to do some, you know, some fooling around, but I can do, you know, I can do these things live with somebody that I pick up. We can go for a ride, have a conversation. We can do it, you know, over phone or Skype. And I just make little videos out of it, you know, trying to figure out how to keep it to, you know, 3 to 4 minutes or less. Sometimes that's not possible.
They're pretty cool as well. So I've listened to some of them. I was on one, I guess, as well. I like the one where you interviewed yourself. But tell me, Mark, where do you get the name from? Is there something to that that I'm maybe not getting here, VulcanCast? Because the only Vulcan I can think of right now is like Spock.
Yeah, right. So, you know, when you go looking for URLs, it's always an adventure. But part of it was I just like the idea of a cast, like a broadcast or something cast, right? And I was trying to think of what's close to the source. Well, Vulcan is close to the sun. But then there was this whole thing that came in sort of after the fact, which is if I do a virtual ride cast where somebody's not physically there and I just put a picture of them, it's kind of like they're beaming over. Right. And it's a Star Trek reference, you know, beam over into the.
So it is.
Yeah. Yeah. That was intentional. Not intentional from the beginning, but it's kind of like, yeah, I like the beam over idea.
Cool. And so where is it? It's vulcancast.com, is it?
Vulcancast.com, yeah. HTTP vulcancast.com. And there's videos growing there. I'm adding some every day now. And it's fun stuff. We're just trying to keep them short, too. That's the other thing. Short videos. Just get in and out.
Not long and boring like the podcast, yeah? No, I'm just kidding. No, it's good, though. For people that consume technology content and news and current affairs and topics and stuff like that that affect the tech world, it's definitely worth the checking out.
Well, you know what I like about it is I get to have conversations with my friends and, you know, and people that I know and expose those. That's fun.
Cool. Yeah. All right. So thanks, everybody, for listening. Again, genuinely, from the bottom of my heart, now I do mean that. I know Gabriel probably wouldn't. Are you listening from Europe?
Gabriel does not have a bottom to his heart. It's that big.
I may very well be the Grinch. So,
yeah. No, I meant the opposite. It's a big heart.
Oh, it is a humongous heart, yes. It's gigantic.
Just misunderstood. But yeah, thanks everybody for listening. Join us next week for another podcast. Reach out to us on the Twitters. Join us on LinkedIn, wherever you are. Thanks for listening. Oh.